iti thus namabi by names Arita was called. Translation. After conquering the enemy, the saintly king Puranjaya gave everything, including the enemy's riches and wives, to Indra, who carries a thunderbolt. For this he is celebrated as Puranjaya. Thus, Puranjaya is known by different names because of his different activities. There's no purport to any of these verses. So, first of all, I'd like to thank Shesha Prabhu for giving me the opportunity to speak. Very kind. And we were going to tell something about our travels in Europe. I think Mother Madhumatish, she wanted to hear about our travels, so she got Shesha to ask if I could give class. So, anyway, we'll do that after a little while. We're going to say a few words. To be honest, I really can't think of a lot to say about these particular verses. They're not very, there's not a lot of things to talk about for me anyway. So I was going to just give my take a little bit on the inconceivable nature of reality, that we see that in the modern world, everything, people try to explain everything by mechanical methods, and it's totally insubstantial. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we come across, and in spiritual realization, spiritual knowledge, everything is so very inconceivable. And this is one of the first qualities of Krishna that we have to understand. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said that this is the most important quality of Krishna, is the achincha shakti of the Lord, that Krishna is inconceivable. And for us to understand Krishna is totally impossible. And even to understand the material nature is completely impossible, because everything is conceived by an inconceivable personality whose intelligence far surpasses ours. And there's a very nice book written by some Hungarian devotees. I was in Hungary, I met these devotees. These are very humble, polite, very pukka devotees, at least the one I met, who had a lot to do with this writing of this book, Nature's IQ. I would advocate that everybody read this book. It's a very, very, very good book explaining how nature is so intelligent by itself that there's no way that evolution could have occurred, how one species of life could go to another species, that certain animals and birds have so many specific qualities which are completely inconceivable. And I was going to give an example of some of these particular species. There's some birds called rock doves. These are known otherwise as homing pigeons. So these rock doves, I'm just going to read, I hope you don't mind. Certain animals have exceptional navigational faculties. Domesticated rock doves, for example, are admired for this ability. Many experiments have examined the orientation of domesticated rock doves, but the results obtained are still equivocal. Some researchers assume that doves use a map and compass strategy. The birds use the sun as a compass, and by the help of their inner clock, compensate for the sun's motion. This means that if the dove is watching the sun at 10 a.m. from a place with a latitude of 45 degrees north and the longitude of 19 degrees east, then it can calculate with the precision of a sextant which direction and at what speed the sun will move. According to some scientists, doves and other animals using the sun compass Learn all this by observing the sun's movements several times when they are young. Even if these assumptions are correct, it is still amazing that birds are born with the ability to acquire and apply this complex knowledge. Moreover, rock doves found their way home, even in experiments in which their sight was hampered by opaque contact lenses. They put contact lenses onto their eyes so they couldn't see properly, and still these birds were able to navigate the way exactly to where the perch was. So this is totally inconceivable. They have this quality, you know, it's built in. A Polish researcher, he took some adult storks in Poland. You see a lot of storks. That's funny. There's big chimneys and different things, and on the top of the chimneys, or even at say like a communications tower, you'll see some storks nesting, and they think this is very auspicious. So this Polish researcher, he took some storks to Israel in an aeroplane, I guess, which is approximately 1,800 miles away. And then he let them free. And they circled around a few times, and immediately they went back to their nest in Poland, just like that. And they traveled about, you know, 1,600 kilometers in approximately 196 hours, where they did about 7 kilometers an hour traveling. They didn't stop on the way. So this is one inconceivable thing. How could these species of life just evolve with this ability? There's another species, there's a certain type of hummingbird which lives in the eastern coast of North America. And then in the winter it goes to South America and the West Indies. So this particular bird, this hummingbird, it only weighs a tenth of an ounce, very, very light. And to get to its migration place in the south, it has to flap its wings. It flaps its wings 6 million times to get there. And it doesn't stop on the way. And if it was too heavy, the weight would not enable it to, you know, fly. But if it didn't have enough energy, it would conk out on the way. So it has to be has to have exactly the right amount of energy. So it stores the energy, a little bit of extra weight in its wings so that it can make the journey. So this is amazing. There's another, the Arctic tern, there's another bird that travels 8,000 miles a year. 8,000 miles. It's a very small bird, only weighs 3 or 4 ounces. And so it, where is that one? The Arctic tern is the record holder for distance among migratory animals. This gull species, with a body weight of 3 to 4 ounces and a wingspan of 29 to 33 inches, flies no less than 22,000 miles every year during its marathon from the Arctic to the Antarctic and back. This is comparable to flying around the world every year. So its nesting area is in the northernmost dry lands of the Northern Hemisphere, Greenland and the polar regions of Canada and Siberia, and sometimes even beyond the Arctic Circle. Anyway, so these species of life, they show how nature's IQ, like Prabhupada said, that, you know, Krishna should be given the Nobel Prize. Forget about these scientists. Krishna's got the greatest brain. He's created all these species of life, that he should be given the Nobel Prize. But of course, scientists are trying to prove that everything is mechanical. So it's very interesting that one of the greatest scientists was Alfred Russel Wallace, Sir Alfred Russel Wallace. And he co-wrote the Origin of the Species with Charles Darwin. I never knew that. But I've been reading this book, Human Devolution, which I would recommend everybody reads it, because it really, it's a wonderful book. And, you know, I think Michael Cremo, what's his name, Tutankhamun, he deserves a medal for, you know, publishing such a very well thought out book, how he has, you know, argued from many different angles how humans have always existed, and there are certain things which are totally beyond human comprehension. So this one scientist, Sir Alfred Russel Wallace, he co-wrote, he was ahead of Charles Darwin. He was going to publish his theory about the origin of the species. So he sent a copy to Darwin to see what he thought. And Darwin's advisors told Darwin, look, he's going to publish this before you. And in the scientific field, priority is everything. So if he publishes it before you, you will never become famous as Charles Darwin. So they co-wrote the paper. And so this Wallace, he was very intelligent. And he actually believed, as well as, you know, how nature evolves somehow or other, he also believed that humans existed 50 million years ago. But he did many experiments, and he was in South America, and he saw certain tribes down there who believed in spiritual things, spirits and whatever. So when he came back to England, at that time there was a lot of interest in seances. Probably you know what a seance is, where you get together with other people and you induce some kind of spiritual being to manifest somehow or other. It's usually invisible, but sometimes, according to the experiments they did, people actually manifested, invisible people. So he, you know, he said, and it's what he wrote was very interesting, because he said, if I can find it. In addition to believing in spirits, Wallace also believed that anatomically modern humans were of considerable antiquity. Oh, I already explained that. So then Wallace encountered the same kind of opposition when he communicated to scientists the results of his spiritualistic research. Describing the reactions of the public and his scientific colleagues, Wallace wrote in his autobiography, "The majority of people today have been brought up in the belief that miracles, ghosts, and the whole series of strange phenomena here described cannot exist, that they are contrary to the laws of nature, that they are the superstitions of a bygone age, and that therefore they are necessarily either impostures or delusions. There is no place in the fabric of their thought into which such facts can be fitted. When I first began this inquiry, it was the same with myself. The facts did not fit into my then existing fabric of thought. All my preconceptions, all my knowledge, all my belief in the supremacy of science and of natural law were against the possibility of such phenomena. And even when, one by one, the facts were forced upon me without possibility of escape from them, still, as Sir David Brewster declared after being at first astonished by the phenomena he saw with Mr. Home, spirit was the last thing I could give into. Every other possible solution was tried and rejected." Because he got all these prominent people in society, big surgeons and doctors and politicians, all kinds of people, to come to his seances. And, you know, this other Sir David Brewster, you know, someone who's knighted, even though we've got a Sir Mick Jagger, but still. At that time, you know, Sir John Lennon, Sir Paul McCartney. Anyway, so every other possible solution was tried and rejected. Unknown laws of nature were found to be of no avail when there was always an unknown intelligence behind the phenomena, an intelligence that showed a human character and individuality, and an individuality which almost invariably claimed to be that of some person who had lived on Earth and who in many cases was able to prove his or her identity. Thus, little by little, a place was made in my fabric of thought. First, for all such well-attested facts, and then, but more slowly, for the spiritualistic interpretation of them. Many people think that when I and others publish accounts of such phenomena, we wish or require our readers to believe them on our testimony. But that is not the case. Neither I nor any other well-instructed spiritualist expects anything of the kind. We write not to convince, but to excite inquiry. We ask our readers not for belief, but for doubt of their own infallibility on this question. We ask for inquiry and patient experiment before hastily concluding that we are, all of us, mere dupes and idiots as regards the subject to which we have devoted our best mental faculties and powers of observation for many years. So, Krishna's inconceivable nature has to be understood through the Vedas. Krishna says, Savasya chaham hridi sanivisto matasmiti gyanam apovanam cha Vedaischa savera hamavivedya vedantakrit vedavit eva chaham. He says, from me come knowledge, remembrance and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of the Vedas and the knower of Vedanta. So if we want to know Krishna, we have to study the Vedas. There's no other way. That's why the first class devotee is one that knows the Vedas. So we also hear, yasya deve parabhakte yatai deve tata karo tasyaite katahiyata prakashanti mahatmana. So for those that have implicit faith in the Vedas and in the spiritual master, all the imports of the Vedas are revealed. So we have to really reject the whole modern way of thinking, the whole materialistic society that we've been brought up in. It's a nonsense, no good. You've already done that. Well done. Because basically, this modern society is causing so many problems. In a recent survey I read, it said that there's four times as much anxiety now as during the Great Depression. We hear of the Great Depression as being, well, as the name implies, very depressing. But there's four times as much anxiety now. Even though there's so much material advancement, and they found that so many more college students have to be counseled because they have so much more anxiety. So when people are totally tuned in and their goal is completely materialistic, then they become very unhappy. So these thinkers, the real thinkers of human society, like this person or even Isaac Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, they were the real scientists because they understood that everything was working by the will of a supreme intelligence. And that supreme intelligence, he is also totally inconceivable, because Krishna himself, he is the supreme controller, but he forgets who he is. When he enters into his intimate relationships with his devotees, he's not even aware of his godhood. He becomes completely submersed in the mood of the child that he's portraying, the relationship that he has with his mother. So this is another inconceivable nature or facet of Krishna. And Krishna's pastimes are very, very beautiful. Like when Krishna was a baby, he saw his reflection in a jeweled pillar. And when he saw his reflection, he said, oh, my friend, I will steal some butter for you. I will give you some nice butter. So his mother, Yashoda, was watching. So she came along and she asked him what he was doing. He was stealing butter. So then he said, but Ma, it was this little boy here, pointing to the reflection. And when I got angry with him and chastised him for stealing the butter, he got angry with me. So these pastimes are very beautiful. And then, just after that, Krishna was taken by the other gopis, the elderly gopis. And Krishna was crying. He said, I want some freshly churned butter. Nothing else will appease me. Please, give me some freshly churned butter. I want that. He pointed to the moon. And so the gopis said, no, that is the moon. You can't have that. That, we cannot get that. It is not freshly churned butter. And they said, I want it, I want it. They said, no, that is a Rajahamsa. That is a celestial swan gliding across the lake of the sky. Well, I want that celestial swan. Give it to me before it reaches the shore. And then they said, no, it's not a celestial swan. It's the moon, but it's got poisonous marks on it. So Krishna says, well, where did the poison come from? And the gopis, they say, well, it comes from the ocean of milk. And Krishna says, well, where did the ocean of milk come from? How many cows did it take to make the ocean of milk? Milk comes from cows, so how many cows made the ocean of milk? So the gopis say, no, the ocean of milk came from the one who created the cows, who gave the cows the ability to create milk. He can create milk without the cows. So then they explain the story of the churning of the milk ocean, and they say the moon has poison on it. But then Krishna says, no, only snakes have poison. Anyway, in this way they have all these exchanges. But the main point is that Krishna is inconceivable and we're incredibly limited. And so to understand Krishna is only possible by Krishna's mercy. And Krishna gives his mercy because we try to demonstrate love for him. Because just as it is said that the ocean is very deep, the sun is very warm, the sages are very grave. In the same way, Krishna is controlled by love. So if we can develop a little bit of love for Krishna, then tesham satada yuktanam, out of compassion for them, I dwelling in their hearts, or he, to those who are constantly devoted, he enlightens us from within. So Krishna is inconceivable. He'll always be inconceivable. But if we try to love Krishna, then we can understand Krishna more and more. And we can understand that without serving Krishna, nobody can be happy. So bhakti yoga is the process by which we develop love of Krishna. So by following this, practicing Krishna consciousness, automatically we will get a glimpse of an understanding of how wonderful Krishna is. And even his material energy is completely wonderful. Just like if you plant a seed in the ground, if it's very instructive to everybody to grow food. If you plant some seeds in the ground and you water them, and you watch them grow, and then you watch if you, for instance, most things you plant, they have a flower before they give the fruit. Just so beautiful. Like if you have a peach tree, or any kind of tree, an orange tree. In fact, the most beautiful smell is the smell of orange or lemon blossom. Very beautiful. And then you get the fruit. Or you plant some zucchini, some squash. So they grow and they grow and they grow. And then there's a nice flower. With squash you get a nice yellow flower. And then from the flower you get the vegetable. It's so amazingly wonderful the way everything works. So anyway, now I'm going to explain a little bit about... Pardon? I was going to explain a bit about our travels. Did you want to help? You can. Well, first of all, we went to the RAF Theatre in London, which was great. They had three beautiful chariots, large chariots, and so many devotees there. What else was it? Sihara Krishna. And then we went to Poland. Oh, say something. Where's the other mic? Huh? The manager left. Yeah, you can use this one.
But the RAF Theatre was amazing in London because it goes right down the center of London to Nelson's Column, Trafalgar Square. And so many non-devotees because it's such a tourist place. And there's just millions of people there and they're all watching and they've stopped all the traffic on the main roads and let the cart go down and the devotees. And three big carts and they're all taking pictures and taking prasadam because they've made thousands and thousands and thousands of sweets to hand out to everyone. And it was just an amazing festival. And when we got to Trafalgar Square and they do a whole program up on the base of the monument and all these people come around and they're watching. And I was just reminded of how Prabhupada in the Chaitanya Charitamrita said that first RAF Theatre there, that the main paper in London had said that this RAF Theatre was a rival to Nelson's Column. And I was thinking it's so true because all these people are just kind of milling around, but as soon as Lord Jagannath came there, millions came to get prasadam and darshan, and it was definitely a rival to Nelson's Column. So it was really nice.
Then we went to Poland, and the Polish tour is a wonderful, it's amazing preaching program, and Indrajana Maharaj is doing a wonderful service there. You stay in a school, you stay in one school, and they rent the school for a couple of months, and there's about 200 devotees that stay in this school, and most of the devotees are like 20, 30 devotees to a room. It's kind of austere. And everybody shares the same bathing facilities, but you get over the austerities. You go to a different town every two or three days, but every day the program goes like this. Mangalati is at 7 o'clock. Okay. Yeah. But you don't take rest till 11 or 12 o'clock. And then you have to squeeze into a bathroom 50 other people. That's kind of austere. But you go, Mangalati is at 7, then there's Japa till 8, then there's Guru Puja for 10 minutes, then there's a short class, and then you take prasadam at 9, and you have to be on the bus at 10. And the bus is like a big bus, like our bus is here. And you go to a town, you know, varying on how close it is, it's between 50 kilometers or like 30 miles to 50 or 60 miles away. And you go there, then you do Harinam. You do Harinam. You usually go on the beach. And this summer was very hot, which is unusual apparently for Poland, because Polish weather's worse than British weather. And Prabhupada said, the sun... Well, it was... I mean, it wasn't humid like this, but it was pretty hot. I mean, and the... I don't know, it was like 90 degrees or something, probably 90, but not humid. Yeah, we all on the roof and
She wants to say.
No, because there's different groups that do different things. So there's the Harnam group, and that was about 100? I guess about 100. And the rest were cooking and getting things together for the... And then they have a setup crew that their main business is setting up all the tents and moving them every couple days and like that. One goes out for Harnam, and then there's two more that come later with...
Three big buses. There's three big buses, and they all hold about 70 people. The first bus is the Harnam bus. That takes about 70 people. So you go to the town, and then... You know, if the weather was nice, so we went on the beach. Now, the beaches are kind of stumpy. They're not like Florida beaches where there's a lot of depth to them. They're very shallow beaches. So, but there's a lot of people. The beaches were totally packed. So we're doing the Harinam, and we're giving out, like, at each Harinam, we give out 8,000 invitations for the festival. And the festival is in the town, and the festival starts at 5 o'clock. So you go on Harinam from 10th, well, usually 11 or something, and you go on Harinam till 2:30. You go on long Harinam, and then you go back to the festival site where all the tents are, and you take prasad and you get a little bit of a break. And then at 5 o'clock, the festival starts, and all these people start coming, and you got a lot of different tents. You've got an astrology tent. Mother Sitala was doing a seminar. There's a magic tent. I mean, a lot of the kind of exhibits or the booths weren't completely straight Krishna consciousness. It's like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He would put on exhibitions. The whole goal was to introduce people to Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, people were attracted by electricity. So he had electric lighting. He had gymnastics. He had maps of the world. He had all kinds of different things just to attract people. And a small part of his exhibition thing was, you know, dioramas and preaching like that. So same with Indrajana Maharaj's thing is that, you know, a lot of it isn't very Krishna conscious. But the most important thing is the kirtan at the end. He gives a lecture. And there's a drama, the Bhagavad Gita, which is very, very well choreographed. It's like a mime with words. Anyway, so all these people flood into the festival site. You usually get like, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 people, I should imagine. They're mainly family people. It's very nice. And then, you know, 9 o'clock, he gives a talk, Bhagavad Gita talk, and then 9:30, there's a kirtan. Finish by 10:30, then you get the bus, you go home, get to bed around midnight, and like that.
But some of the tents aren't, like, they have a book tent that's distributing Prabhupada's books, and their Radha and Krishna deities, Radha Vallabha, stay there in that tent during the day. They have prasadam restaurant, and it seemed like the Polish people were so into eating tons of prasadam. You always saw people walking around with plates of prasadam. And they sell that. And then they have Gopi Dot tent where they're putting on, that was the most popular, I think. And they had a putting on saris tent. And so many ladies had saris, and they were getting their pictures. And at one point, because I didn't know the devotees there, it was hard to tell which were the devotees and which were the non-devotees. They'd put tilak and gopi dots, and so did the devotees have that, and it was funny. And they would even go out and walk in the town sometimes with their saris on and stuff. There was also the magic show, but that devotee would get everyone to chant Hare Krishna. So they'd have like two or three showings, and they would close the door on the tent. And then you'd hear this loud, Hare Krishna, coming out of the magic tent, all these children. And they also had a questions and answers booth, which we did. But because the Polish people only speak Polish, So you'd have to have a translator there. But it was really nice because they would ask a lot of nice questions about what is death, how can we become more spiritual in our life. Some would ask, what's the markings on your forehead, or how do we know that we're not this body, or nice actual questions so we could answer, and it really made you think about, you know, how to answer each person where they're at, and I found that really nice. And they also had the seminar, which was on happiness, how to bring happiness into your life, which Sitala Prabhu did. And they had a yoga tent for yoga, hatha yoga. Anyway, it was a really nice program. No, they just write their name down so that they give it back in their phone number.
Jesha, Prabhu. It's just one base. Yeah, we go. Because a lot of the population go to the Baltic coast in the summer. And so from, you know, the beginning of July till the latter part of August, the Baltic Sea is very crowded. So, you know, there's a lot of people there, yeah. And all the tourist resorts are within striking range of that base. Anyway, then after Poland, well, we went to the Woodstock Festival as well, which was pretty ecstatic. There was very nice kirtans there. Madhava was there, Madhava and Bibi Govinda Maharaj have long kirtans. Anyway, we know what their kirtans are like. They're very ecstatic. After that, we went to Czech. And we went to the farm there. They have a nice farm there. And on the farm, they grow their own wheat. And they mill their own wheat. And they sell flour. And they have oxen. They have a padyatra every year. They use their oxen to go on padyatra. And in Prague, they have three restaurants, nice restaurants. It's going nicely. They're getting a new place in Prague, just outside the city. There's a lot of nice devotees there. One devotee, he had 120 beehives on the farm. So he makes a living selling honey, which is nice. 3 tons of honey. Yeah, he had so much honey.
And all different colors.
Oh yeah, white honey, brown honey, yellow honey. It's amazing. And then we went to Amsterdam. And Amsterdam, there's a devotee called Dhananjaya and Balagopal. Dhananjaya was one of the first British devotees, if you know Dhananjaya. Anyway, he's really gone out on a limb. He gave up living in Vrindavan to go to Amsterdam because Hare Krishna Das, you probably don't know him, but he was a Dutch devotee. He was Sarabi Maharaj's, ex-Maharaj's brother. And so he's a very successful businessman, and he makes money doing alternative energy. So he just signed a contract with the Hungarian government to supply these huge windmills. In Europe, there's a lot of these windmills. In fact, he was telling us that 20% of the energy in Germany comes from alternative energy sources, like these windmills. They have a lot of huge solar power panel things. But most places you go, you see these huge windmills. I mean, I don't really like the look of them, but it's better than a power station. But, you know, it's a lot better environmentally speaking. Anyway, so he's making a good living, so he bought this building in Amsterdam, and his son convinced Dhananjaya and his wife Balagopal to go there and be the president. So he is there. They have a small temple there, which has been there for a while, which isn't very impressive. But Dhananjaya, he walks every morning. He gets up at 1:45 every morning and walks to the temple that they have, which is about, it's at least 5 miles. He walks there at 2:30 in the morning, which is pretty amazing. He's like, he's big, Dhananjaya. And he's over 60. And he said, this is the greatest challenge of my life. So meanwhile, they're fixing up this new facility, which is a great facility. It's like 4,000 square feet. It's a big building. It was owned by one famous sculptor in Holland. And it's right by a nice canal. If you've ever been to Amsterdam, so many canals there, and it's right near the city center. So it's a great facility, and Hare Krishna Das, he bought that building, he's fixing it up, so, you know, he's going to have a restaurant and everything else. It's great. Yeah. No, it's not open yet. No, they're there all by themselves in that building, and you know, Balagopal and Ruchir are the best of friends, so, you know, they invited us to go there, so we went to see him. And where else did we? Oh, Hungary. This was probably the highlight of our trip, Hungary. If you've ever been to Hungary, I know it's late, but I'll just tell you about it quickly. The Hungarian Yatra is the best organized Yatra that I've seen in ISKCON. It's the kind of place, well, it's such a place that when I go there, I feel this is the way Prabhupada wanted things. It's so well organized, so it's fantastic. So they have this beautiful temple in Budapest, which is a really nice building. Very well, the temple room is beautifully designed, and they're doing all this preaching there. They have 2 or 3 restaurants in Budapest, and they have a Bhaktivedanta College, which is a devotee-run university that people can go to and get a government degree. And a lot of the time, those students, they're on the farm, which is like 150 miles away, and they're helping out on the farm. And the farm itself is it's amazingly well designed. You know, the road you come in on has these beautiful brick designs. I mean, it's at least 1/2 mile long. And they have about 30 houses. The houses cost $100,000 each. So that's $3 million right there. And the Goshal, that cost about $500,000. So somehow or other, all these devotees, and they've got brahmacharis collecting, they've got people coming, so many guests coming every year, they get about 20,000-30,000 non-devotees coming to visit the farm. They get so many people coming, and everything about the place is just wonderful. You know, it's there's a beautiful underground storage facility, like a root cellar, which is very nicely built with bricks, and very large for storing vegetables in the winter and canning things and grains and whatever else, and it's the same temperature the whole year round. So I would recommend everybody save up and go to Hungary. It's really worth the visit. You really be completely bowled over. And the devotees themselves are so polite and sweet. and yeah, they're very respectful. They're really wonderful people. And that's another thing we found on the Polish tour, that the devotees were so nice, because so many nice devotees here. And over there, though, they really appreciate senior devotees' guidance and association, and especially my wife. They're more interested in her than me. But she gave a lot of seminars for the ladies, because they don't get many older lady association. So any older ladies want to go over there, you'll be more than welcome. So in Hungary, there's 20 full-time pujaris. So, you know, their overhead is like $1.5 million a year. Because people might say, well, that's strange for a self-sufficient farm that they have such a big overhead. But the real reason is that they're building up the, you know, the infrastructure, that they're building all these houses. See, the houses are nice. They cost a lot of money to build, because I think Shiva Ram Maharaj, or the management there, or between them, they've realized that for modern people to live very, very simply may be too difficult. So rather have a nice place which is more comfortable, because also there they have to be inside a lot of the year because of the climate. Like, it's okay if you live in, you know, Ekachakra or somewhere. In India, you can live in a mud house because you can play outside a lot of the year, most of the year round. But in Hungary, you know, you're going to be inside most of the year, so you need a decent place to live. But they're all non-electric. They don't have electricity there. And then what? Well, bricks are made from mud, yeah. But anyway, it's a great place. What else?
One thing, their deity worship was really amazing. They, in front of the deities, they have bowls of sweets that they keep there during the day, and they'll change it, and they have a little net over it so the flies don't. And then they have a tiffin next to the deities with prasadam in it in case they're hungry in between their meals. And they have a nice fan. You know, Prabhupada talked about how in the old temples they used to be able to fan the deities from outside. So they have a nice peacock fan above the deities and a string outside the altar that you can pull and fan the Lord during the day at any time. And it's really so nicely personal, you know. And everyone, because they don't have TVs and things, everyone's there in the evening for chanting for the deities, and they're there in the morning. And it's very well attended, the temple programs and all, which is really nice.
Aside from organizing all of this, Shiva Ram Raj is also writing a 6-volume book, which each volume is about 600 pages, with 200 new illustrations. So it's pretty amazing. So if you can save up for the book, it's about $300 or more. But I'm sure it's worth it. Say that again? Well, it's part of the Krishna and Vrindavan series, yeah. A lot of it is to do with New Brajadham. I don't know the details. A part of the book which he sent me was, anyway, I think it's, I'm not supposed to say anything about it. But another thing about New Brajadham is that there are many holy places in New Brajadham which he has delineated, because like Prabhupada in New Vrindavan, he wanted different holy tirthas. So Shiva Ram Maharaj is doing that in New Brajadham. You know, there's a Govardhan Hill, there's a Nandagram, he's identified about 2,000 holy places. So, you know, there's already about 20 established, and each holy place they have, you know, a kund, an Indian-style gazebo. Each holy place costs about $40,000 to build, actually. There's many kuns. Anyway, it's amazing. When we were there on the Sunday, we went out to one of the holy places, and he gave the class from the Chaitanya Charitamrita out there in the field, in the holy place. It was very nice. Anyway, I think it's late now. We have to finish. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.